Time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, of why the sea is boiling hot and whether pigs have wings. As you all know, that's taken from Alice in Wonderland, published 150 years ago. And today I'm going to talk about many things, probably not cabbages, but certainly kings, because today we're celebrating Christ the King. Now, when I say the word king, what picture comes into your mind?
Crowns.
Oh, thank you. Crowns. You think of a crown. Okay, yeah. Any other suggestions?
Henry VIII.
Sorry, one at a time. Henry VIII, yes. A throne. I was waiting for somebody to say Elvis, but we haven't had that. Or possibly the king's head, but we haven't had that either. But you've gone for some of the more symbolic things, like the throne and the crown, which is good. And just going to crowns for a minute, I think we might also think of paper crowns in Christmas crackers. We might think of children's nursery rhymes like Old King Cole, or there's that one about the king who wanted a bit of butter on his bread. Do you remember that one? The trouble with the title king is that nowadays it is sometimes, perhaps often, vaguely comic. In the 21st century, we don't have many hereditary kings left, and they are largely ceremonial. There's a king of the Netherlands, and of the Belgians, and Norway, and possibly Sweden. I'm not quite sure about that. But in the 21st century, the very title king can sound old-fashioned, anachronistic, comic even. There's a danger here for us. We can sound old-fashioned, anachronistic, and comic when we speak of Christ the King to anyone who doesn't share our Christian faith. So let's unpack the idea a little more. What is a king? What do we want and expect from a king? What are the expectations of a king of us? Well, as you all know, the title is usually inherited by the eldest son on the death of his father. The king is king by accident of birth. The title does not depend on merit. But it does, or it did, usually confer privilege, wealth, and power with expectations. In the Bible, when the people of Israel went to the prophet Samuel to demand a king, this is what they were told. I'm just going to read a bit from Samuel. Samuel went off. Samuel was put out, and he went off and talked to God and said, "They want a king." And God said to Samuel, "Tell them this," and this is what Samuel said. "This is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plough his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your wine and give it to his officials and attendants. your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. And when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we shall be like all the other nations, and with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. So Samuel heard all this. He went and repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, listen to them and give them a king. Samuel went on to anoint Saul as the first king of Israel, and we all know that there were very mixed fortunes for the people of Israel after that. But it's interesting that there was this anointing. Samuel anointed Saul, and the anointing of the monarch as God's chosen one continues to be part of our coronation services and of many coronation services. And unfortunately, it has also led to the belief of some kings that they are indispensable, that they have a divine right to rule, that they were not responsible or answerable to their subjects. Well, I know the answer to this question because we've already had it. Who was our most famous king? Henry VIII. He began his rule, the golden boy, full of talent and promise. He ended it, corpulent, capricious, cruel. Other kings, too many to name. How about King Ludwig II of Bavaria, who built extravagant fairy tale castles and lost his kingdom and his mind? I could go on and on. We have an ambivalent attitude to our kings because they do not live up to our longings and expectations. But we still want one, or at least we want and need a leader. The alternatives, presidents and prime ministers, don't live up to our expectations either. So eventually, we remove them. At the end of World War II, Winston Churchill lost the general election to Clement Attlee, much to his disgust. The achievement, that's Churchill, not Attlee's disgust, I should hasten to add. The achievements of Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair are still controversial. Nevertheless, we still want to be led. And we want to be led by people of strength and courage and nobility, integrity, wisdom and charisma. We want to be inspired. We want a vision. And when the vision sours and leaders do not live up to our ideals, we remove them. Is that inevitable? At the human level, maybe. Nevertheless, Christ, God's Son, came to the world as an ordinary, humble human being. But as a man with astonishing, extraordinary gifts of wisdom and healing, teaching, leadership, compassion, charisma, and grace. Too much for those who sent him to a cruel death. He rose again. Death could not hold him. And early Christian art depicts Christ the King enthroned, victorious, on the cross. the cross which is for us the tree of life. Life for human beings at the expense of Christ's blood. The divine paradox is this. The dazzling vision of Christ enthroned in glory, the vision we all hope and long for, the vision which sustains us in our darkest hour, has been achieved not by might or force of arms, but by suffering and service and sacrifice. And God promises us that suffering is not in vain. We need a vision of grace and power. It is our light and our salvation. It gives our lives meaning and purpose. Think of poor benighted Job in all his misery. What ultimately gives him hope? He doesn't get an explanation from God. No reason, but he gets a vision. A vision of God in power. Think of the black slaves on the American plantations. What sustains them in their agony? A vision of God in power and glory. I'm going to finish with some words from St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians chapter 1. How extraordinarily great is the power of God exercised in raising Christ from the dead and enthroning him at his right hand in heaven, far above every principality, ruling force, power, or sovereignty, not only in this age, but in the age to come. God has put all things under his feet and made him, as he is, above all things, the head of the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who is filled all in all. To him be glory forever.